This is Castle One. Race officer speaking.
Lay on the head on boundary up ahead, 35 seconds out.
A bit lower and faster here.
Ho ho ho! That's a good one, Jimmy.
Still gaining on the lay line there.
Welcome back, podcast listeners, and thanks for joining us for this, the second part of our chat with 37th America's Cup challenger, American Magic. Obviously, if you're tuning in without having first listened to part one, it would make sense to head back and give that a listen first. As well as a bit of team background, we talked to the team's co-helm, Tom Slingsby, sailing supercoach, Tom Burnham, and rising sailing star, Harry Meldges IV. And we've plenty more chat from the team in this edition. But before we get going, if you're enjoying the podcast, then please do head over to buymeacoffee.com/sailingpodcast. It's easy to do. Your support helps keep us free from annoying ads. And if you've not already done so, then head over and buy us a coffee or two. Many thanks. Coming up in this edition, a little bit later, we chat to design team member David Oliver about the changes in design between this edition and the Cup in Auckland, the challenges of building the world's fastest raceboat, and what advances in AC75 design we may expect to see this time around. We also talked to another of the team's young backup helms, US Olympic sailor Riley Gibbs, a sailor with an infectious enthusiasm for sailing fast. And we close the chat with sailing team boss Terry Hutchinson. But we kick things off with another key member of the sailing team, mainsail trimmer for the team in Auckland, co-helm for this edition, British Olympic gold medalist and multiple Moth world champion, Paul Goodison. I hope you enjoy the time I spent with American Magic.
Yeah, I've had my rivalries in the past with Tom, but if you were going to choose anybody to be alongside you, racing with you, he's the guy you want.
The guys make it look easy, sailing them around out there and keeping it up, but in 6.5 knots of wind, the physics are still a bit against you.
We were out sailing, we bore away in about 16 knots breeze and started going 51 knots. The ice water there in both those guys' veins as they're talking in the comms, like nothing's happening.
Our first chat is with American Magic co-helm Paul Goodison. Goody was part of the Swedish Artemis team for the 2017 Cup in Bermuda and was then mainsail trimmer for American Magic's first Cup in Auckland and re-signed early in this campaign as co-helm. Paul Goodison, it's good to have you back on the podcast and congratulations on your win in Villanova. I've got to say, you looked like you were loving it and it's great to see you smiling again.
It's been so long since we've been racing these kind of boats, and to kind of have the last racing experience in American Magic with a boat not quite working and on very different terms, it was awesome to kick off this campaign's racing in the style that we did, and it was just so good to have Doug on the bow after we'd finished spraying the champagne and on the phone to Hap. Like, it really did feel like a special moment that we'd been waiting a long time for.
Yeah, it felt way more than a weekend in Villanova, didn't it?
No, it did for sure.
It's been a tough couple of cups for you, as you've just said. I mean, how's life for Goody now in Barcelona? You've been out on the bike this morning. It's not a bad city to be working in, is it?
Oh, it's fantastic. I love being here. My family's very happy here. My little man's in school here and getting along great. So it's an environment I feel very comfortable in. The sailing obviously is quite tricky, sailing in bigger waves and more challenging conditions than we're used to. But on that side, it's also that sort of stuff excites me because it feels like you're learning again and again. It's not like you're going through the same thing and learning the same things. There's a whole new skill set that you need to develop, and there's a whole new design philosophy you need to embrace. So that side of things, it's really exciting and intriguing.
It's going to make the Heraki Gulf look like a walk in the park, isn't it? It is a challenging racetrack.
No, for sure. It's from sailing in Pensacola or or the Heraki Gulf is very easy to sail these sorts of boats to a reasonable standard, but to sail them in big waves and swell and lighter or stronger winds, it's a completely different kettle of fish.
Let's venture back a little to the Heraki Gulf and talk about Auckland. The campaign punctuated by one particular incident. In the short term, the team bounced back hard, but long term, you know, how much did all of that hurt, taking a big fall like the capsize?
I think the biggest thing for me and as being part of the team is you put so much effort, you put so much work, and you devote so much of your life to that one moment. It's very similar to, like, as you know, with the Olympic careers, you spend 4 years focused on one goal, and then to see yourself and the team fall short is so disappointing, and you spend a lot of time looking back and trying to figure out where things went wrong, and everybody looks back and sees the obvious one as a capsize, but it wasn't just the capsize. It was a decision we'd made a year before that, decision we'd made 18 months before that to give us the boat we were in and the equipment we're in. And we got a few things wrong, but we also did a lot of things right. So there was kind of mixed emotions. We were talking about this the other day with Terry, whether it was seen as a high or a low. And you look back and there are some definite lows to last campaign, but there are also a lot of highs and a lot of things we did right. So moving into this cycle, there's a lot of positive energy.
It's hard to describe, I think, the intensity to other people of a cup and working in a team. I mean, how would you describe it? And, you know, that final push towards the cup, what's it like?
It's all engrossing. It definitely sucks you in and doesn't leave much time for anything else. But I think up until this point, this time around, we have done a really good job of managing the time and managing the workload. We've had some very clear, intensive pushes where we lead into a decision or lead into a natural break, whether that be a change in a venue, a fall decision or a haul decision. And from that side of thing, I think energy levels have been really well managed to the point where you can see just before a decision is about to make that everybody's working hard, everybody's getting tired, and it's taken its toll a little bit. But they can see the light at the end of the tunnel, which is, okay, we've made the decision. There's now an almost an enforced break, and then we come back and we work on the next decision or the next part of the program. It does feel like we are very kind of process-driven and goal-driven, and it feels really good. And that's going to be something that gets tough to manage. Now we move into this part of the cycle where you can almost see the finish line and being able to know when to take your foot off the gas a little bit and enforce a little bit of a reflection time before you go again. It's definitely going to be hard to manage, but I think you're just around so many like-minded people that are desperate to win that you all kind of carry each other through at the final part.
I remember a coach telling me once not to confuse endeavour with achievement. Sometimes you have to...
No, that's
not right. Always about the hours, is it? I mean, I'm curious, Goody, what's changed? What's changed since Auckland? I mean, what's the legacy been of all that heartbreak in New Zealand?
I think a lot's changed. There's been quite a big change within the sailing team, within the design team, within the shore team, obviously. You keep some of the best people, but you also lose some of the good guys to other teams, and then you bring in more guys. And one really good thing is that we have a great group of people that have come from other teams. So you kind of get an insight into what the other teams did well, what the other teams did badly, and it's you learn from all these experiences. And it's about trying to put those all into perspective and realize where you're going to focus your energy and how you're going to structure yourself a little bit.
You feel a real sense of determination, renewed determination, I think, when you just come here for the day. I mean, how would you compare American Magic version 2 to what you had before?
I think the thing that strikes home more to me probably this time is there a bigger sense of belief. There's more people around here in every department that believe that this is possible, believe that we can win. I think going into the campaign for the first time round, there's a lot of hope. Everybody hopes they can win. Everybody wants to win. But having the belief that you're capable and you have the right people to win. And I think coming back from Villanova and seeing the team perform for the first time, it not only reinforces the belief, but it also strengthens the belief. And I think one of things that we really have going for us here at American Magic is the belief everybody has every day that we come to work.
You were in the team for Auckland, as we've said, but for this campaign, you share helming duties. I mean, what did you think when Terry told you Tom Slingsby was joining the team?
It was a really interesting one because I'd end up signing reasonably early on in the campaign, and we were discussing at length how best to tackle it. And we were both aligned, myself and Terry, that we needed two helmsmen. And it basically came down to, if you could pick anybody else to be your offside, who would it be? And you look at everybody in the world of sailing, and yeah, I've had my rivalries in the past with Tom, but if you were going to choose anybody to be alongside you, racing with you, he's the guy you want. So it was, from that point on, it was basically a process of getting Tom to come and join the team, and thankfully he did.
Paul, you said that you told Terry that you have to have two helms. You know, why was that? And what did you see in Luna Rossa in Auckland that made you think that?
Well, one of the biggest things for me was the debrief we had after last time, where the mistakes we made racing and where the decision-making process evolves between a single and a dual helmsman. And some of the weaknesses, I probably don't want to go too far into it because I'll be giving a lot away, from what we saw in our starting and our the way we ran the boat. We fell short quite hard in certain aspects. And the real thing where I think Luna Rossa got right was a dual helmsman, having the guys freed up to be able to do certain things and be always stationary, always in the position and always ready to react. And that was the biggest thing for me why I think we needed to go down that path, as well as the obvious gains of the windage and the moving sides of the boat, which is, again, a big one.
How are you gelling now on the boat? How is that all kind of working?
It's a really interesting one because day-to-day life, say 3 months ago, 4 months ago, we're sailing the 40s, we very rarely sail together. So we're always going at each other pretty hard on the water. And it's not always flowers and rainbows. At times we do clash a little bit. But the times running up to Villanova, we spent probably a week sailing together, and we have our different ways of thinking about situations and different ways of executing, but it's almost just being aware of a global plan and then being very good at knowing when you're in charge and when you're running the other side of the boat. So we very much have it that whoever's the windward side helmsman is basically the tactician and running the show. And then when we maneuver, it switches roles where you give an information or you're receiving information. And I don't think it worked perfectly in Villanova, but the result was very good. It's a work in process, and it's something that we're trying to develop not only on the water but also in the simulator, in the classroom, in the debrief, just how we interact and what brings the best out of each other. So work in progress, but it's going pretty well so far.
I can imagine it's pretty tough. I mean, a sailing yacht doesn't really work like that. There's always someone who makes the final decision.
Yeah.
It's tough. Give us a bit more of a glimpse into that dialogue and decision-making process between the two of you.
Again, like I mentioned earlier, the biggest differences are when you're on the windward side, you're basically the skipper. And when you're on the leeward side, you're basically the strategist and giving away information. So I think as soon as we go up against another boat, we are very much always on the same page and always battling to beat the hell out of whoever we're racing against and to win. And it's almost like there's the shift changes when we're on different boats. And then you come into the debrief and explain in different moves why one chooses one chooses the other. And it's a real eye-opener into somebody else's world of how they tackle things. And again, It's a great learning process. We debate quite hard the reasonings for one thing and the other, and we come up to mutual agreements most of the time, and sometimes we just agree to disagree and we carry on. But I feel at the moment it's a fantastic working relationship and something I feel like I'm thriving in.
Can push each other. It's fantastic.
Definitely.
Let's talk a little bit about sailing out here in Barcelona. We did mention it earlier. For our listeners, to describe what you get here.
I guess historically it should be quite large waves, more swell base than chop base, and always a little bit off from the wind angle, so it makes one tack a little trickier than the other. And then the same downwind one tack ends up, or one jibe ends up being a little more difficult than the other. So you could easily set the boat up asymmetrically with different size foils to suit different wave angles, and you could really push down different design paths for different sides of the boats, or you keep them similar and mowed otherwise. But it's really intriguing. I think the one thing that you will get is some really interesting racing.
Well, yeah, it won't be boring, that's for sure. Goody, you're not just sailing the yacht, are you? I mean, you're involved pretty heavily in it all. I mean, how much do you work with the design team on stuff? I mean, how intense is all of that? Give us a glimpse into your day.
It's pretty intense. Like every minute of the day, you are thinking about stuff. You are going through stuff, not of your own ideas, but of other people's ideas from different parts of the design team, whether that's aero, hydro, and linking it all together. So I'm deeply involved with probably every area, probably more areas than I should be, because it doesn't seem like I have 5 minutes to almost think about the sailing at times. But it's something that really excites me. Just learning how the boat operates and learning how each department here interacts, and almost being the go-between between a lot of the areas while you're at work discussing what's happening in one area with happening in hydro, what's happening in sails, and how they interact, and being involved with the shore side of what the guys can change to help certain things happen. It's all encompassing, but it's very rewarding, and it's great to be working with so many people.
You can sense, even just speaking to you now, that you know how much you're loving it, being part of it. How much do you think you've got a chance this time?
I think we've got a real chance, and I think everybody here, like I spoke about earlier, there is a belief that we are good enough on our day to do this and to get over the final line. And I think if we get a boat that we think we're gonna receive to the level it's gonna receive, and we race as well as we know we're able to, then I think on our day we're gonna be right there.
Can't wait to see it all unfold. Goody, it's great to have you back on the podcast. Thanks as ever. We'll catch up soon.
Nice. Thanks.
Paul Goodison echoing his co-helm's thoughts from the previous episode. They're a confident team. Big thanks to Goody, an ex-Team GB teammate of mine, of course. If you want to hear more from Paul, jump back through the podcast archive for a full two-parter from the Olympic gold medalist. Next up, we're talking AC75 design with one of American Magic's key naval architects, David Oliver. As we know, the AC75 is currently in its second cup cycle. There's been a few tweaks to the design rules for this cup, and as we'll hear, the design team's goal is to create an AC75 that represents the fastest possible interpretation of the AC75 class rule. Welcome, David Oliver. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Design team at American Magic. Tell us, what's your role here within the team? What do you do?
So this is the first cup campaign for myself, and I'm a member of the design team within the VPP department. So that's the velocity prediction program. So our team is responsible for design, for measuring the performance of all the different components that the other team members are designing.
You make it sound so easy. What does that look like? Explain it.
So we use a specific set of software tools, and we work with each of the other design groups, so whether it be the foil designers, the hull designers, sail designers, and they give us some information that they might want to analyze. We then take that and we aid in the simulations that they run themselves, and we also run that through our software tools and race models and things of that nature. And that gives us a look at how the boat's going to perform from a VMG standpoint. So they can, those other designers, we can give them feedback on, okay, is this shape change giving you a measurable gain in performance or not? And just kind of help them look and where to go next.
That's an exciting job. I mean, you've worked on some amazing boat projects today. Tell us a little bit about that. And I'm right in thinking, well, you said it's your very first cup campaign. What's it like? How exciting is it to work at this level of the sport?
It's incredibly exciting to be a part of it. As a lifelong sailor, it's something you always dream to be a part of, and you couldn't ask for a better first experience, I think, than to be a part of American Magic here. We got a great team of people, very supportive, and a very tight-knit design staff. So you really feel like you can make a contribution wherever that may be. So a lot of us float around in roles that may vary from day to day. But it's been good. My background is in naval architecture, and so when you think about how the cup world is compared to other design projects that are at a big scale, you face really the demanding pressure on time and project management. I think they go hand in hand with the details of the designs themselves. So you see that in the cup world too.
You're allowed to show off a little bit. I mean, just tell our listeners, name some of the fantastic boats you've been involved in.
So I've had the opportunity to join Reichel Pugh Yacht Design right out of college, and worked with them for almost 10 years before jumping over to do this. And so we worked on some of the big super yachts. Maesong, the 130-foot yacht, which sadly is no more, but also two Wally Centos, and most recently the 154-foot Nalaya that's now out sailing. So it's just some really cool projects at a very different end of the sailing spectrum, but yeah, some immense challenges in those that you learn to how to work as a team to overcome and how to meet the demands of a schedule from a much different perspective, but equally exciting and very rewarding for sure.
Some of the coolest bows. And as you say, very innovative projects in their own right.
Yeah, pushing the limits in other areas for sure.
Maesong fell off a ship, which was, it must have been heartbreaking.
It was at least 2 years for myself in the design and build process, and pretty gut-wrenching text to wake up to one morning and see that it was underwater.
All right, let's go back to the cup. It's an exciting time, isn't it? Less than a year to go to the cup. Before we get into things, we're just going to recap. So this is the second cup that we'll see the AC75. And as a team that was in Auckland, you're allowed to sail a previous AC75, in your case, Patriot, as a test bed, and also build a new AC75 for competition. I mean, that's correct. Just explain that to us, how that works with a new team and an existing team.
Well, as an existing team, we have the ability to sail, as you say, a previous generation boat. So we have some, one, it gives us known quantities of the components. So we have a hull or we have foils that we have sailed with before. We have some data on those pieces. And then as we can continue to sail them, so we can make some adjustments and benchmark those adjustments based on what we already know about the boat, which gives us a good feeling for, are we making steps in the right direction? Are these incremental changes adding up to incremental gains where we expect them? And then, of course, all that funnels into the new boat, and we try and test what we can between the AC40s and Patriot, but we test as much as we can on the water to give us a good validation before we move to the next step. And not everything you can, we can't test the AC75 foils at that full size before we go on to the next stage, but we think we get a really good understanding with being able to sail the boat again.
From a rules perspective, are there changes to the AC75 you can build now compared to what you would have been able to build for Auckland?
Yes. So the new generation of the boat, they'll be lighter, and the big predominant changes are in the foil sizes, or not size so much, but the class rule restricting the foil dimensions, I should say. So the foils this time around have a longer span, longer wingspan. They sit a little bit deeper below the foil arm. And the boat being lighter, this all enables the new generation of AC-75s to, the goal is to enable them to sail in a broader range of wind strengths. So the new protocol will have us going all the way down to 6.5 knots of breeze, and I think all teams will be really challenged to see how well their designs will execute in those conditions. So it's going to be exciting to watch for sure.
What do you mean by that?
And how the teams are challenged? I think, you know, it's easy to forget that it's still a, you know, just less than 6.5 ton boat that's completely out of the water. So the guys make it look easy, sailing them around out there and keeping it up at 99-100% flight time. But in 6.5 knots of wind, the physics are still a bit against you. you can do it, but you need the absolute maximum efficiency out of the whole package, whether that be foils, sails, and sailors on board. It all matters.
How much progress do you think there'll be in these version 2 AC-75s from a performance perspective?
I think there'll be a good leap here. You know, to the casual observer, they will probably look quite similar, but to those of us in the design world, I think we'll be seeing some big changes as teams really move to exploit everything that they can out of these rules. It's quite a strict class rule, but I think there are still some areas that we can make some gains, and we'll all be eager to see what the other teams come out with, for sure.
What kind of areas? I mean, if you're a cup fan, what should you be looking at?
I mean, I think we saw Team New Zealand with quite an innovative hull shape in the last cycle. And so I think we'll see teams factoring that style of design into their hull shapes. It would be interesting to see, you know, who else goes down that path. And there's still the mast lower zone, which enables teams to put really any sail controls they want in that range, or excuse me, in that region of the mainsail. So how teams are able to control the lower portion of their wing and extract the real optimum best performance out of that area, I think, you know, there's a lot that could be explored in that region. And again, always interesting to see how we can take full advantage of it.
What about what to expect to see from the other teams? I mean, as the AC-75 moves into its second iteration, do you think the designs will homogenize to some degree? Will we see similar interpretations of the class rule?
I think we could. Yeah, it's a bit hard to say. We of course have our own perspective here, but I think they're based on what the teams are testing and what proved to be good, really strong concepts in the last cup. I think some things may well homogenize to a certain area of the rule. Hard to say where that will be and if we'll be in the same corner. We'll see.
We seem to always hear in cup design circles the dreaded phrase, lead times. Mm-hmm. I mean, explain the relevance of that. How early did you have to lock in your design decisions, and how scary a design landscape is that?
Well, I think it's always scary, I think, no matter how early you do it, because you just really don't know what your competitors are up to. But for us, a key is really balancing how much time we have on the water with the new boat. And so then everything starts to work backwards from there. If we anticipate the new boat to launch in the springtime, you know, we have a fixed window of time to get the guys on board and sailing and preparing for the competition. So you work backwards, and we know the builders have a very, very specific schedule. We're a great group of guys in Rhode Island that are doing the construction work. So they know to the day, you know, what it's going to take them to put this boat together. So that was a big driver, and it all works back from when you want to have the boat in hand on the water ready to go. And the same goes for the other components, the foils as well. Our team here working with the machine shops that are producing them and working back to you know, just how many days it's going to take to for each step of the process, from design to structural engineering and all the detail refinement into the build.
What happens if you make a big design breakthrough once the build is underway? What if you have, like, you wake up in the middle of the night with a great idea? How does that work?
Well, I think that's unlike some of the other projects out there. That's just that's the beauty and the fun of the America's Cup, I think, is that if you have a breakthrough and if you have some really key idea, you can make it happen. You're surrounded by a team of people that are willing to just turn everything upside down if need be to incorporate a feature or to really get the most out of what you're building. And that's just, yeah, you it's hard to find that any other place. Just the willingness and the motivation from everyone to make ideas happen. That's pretty cool.
Be careful, that's addictive.
No question about it.
I'm sure there's lots of your colleagues who come time and time again. You know, as a challenger, obviously, you need to win the Challenger Series to make it to the Cup. How tough is it to design a boat that needs to be competitive in August all the way through a weather window of the Challenger Series and then maybe the Cup match as well? How hard is that to get your head around?
Yeah, it's certainly a difficult challenge to tackle. Because we can design so much, but if a lot of it comes down to meteorology and that's, you know, we can't design that to the best of our efforts. I think the key in the philosophy is keeping a design and a boat that is a well-rounded package. So we have an area, of course, that we would like to tailor it to and focus to try and have the best chance at having best performance in the window we expect. Of course, we don't know if we're going to get that weather window, so we have to keep a good level of performance across the whole wind range. But I think it's all the other teams will have been looking at similar climate data and trying to understand where exactly that wind range, the wind bin they want to fall into is. But I think we know we think we know it's on the lighter side. Whether it'll be there, we don't know for sure.
That's sailing, isn't it?
Sure.
I mean, David, what do you think that moment's going to be like when the teams start launching their cup boats? I mean, that moment always fascinates me. But from a designer's standpoint, how eager are you to see the other team's design interpretations?
I can't wait. Honestly, it's again, maybe that's the first timer enthusiasm here, but it's just, how often do you get to see four of these boats that nobody's ever seen before hit the water in a short span of time? This time. So yeah, we'll be watching, and everybody will be dialed in, ready to take measurements and get as much as we can from all the recon photos. We'll be watching very carefully.
David Oliver, we wish you all the very best with it all. We're excited, and many thanks for joining us on the podcast. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. It's really fun to be here.
A big thanks to David for his time. The America's Cup design teams are all under a huge amount of pressure, so a big thanks for sitting down with us. And for all you fans of the design aspect of the Cup, we'll be bringing you a deep dive into the new AC75s once the boats start launching sometime in the spring. Our next chat is with another one of the team's youngsters, backup helm Riley Gibbs. Riley sailed for Team USA at the Tokyo Olympics, finishing in ninth place in the NACRA 17 with crew Anna Vise. You'll hear Riley's enthusiasm for the sport in everything he says. But you obviously can't see Riley while he's talking. So I have to tell you, that enthusiasm, that love of sailing is so very obvious as he talks about his role in the team. It's great to see. Riley Gibbs, first time on the podcast. Welcome, and many thanks for coming on. I'm told by Tim, our producer, that you're a podcast fan. Is that right?
Yeah, I may have let that slip. I think when you were here earlier this summer, working with ACTV, I believe. But yeah, no, it's great. Good listens, you know, a lot of people I'd aspire to be one day and meet, you know.
Who's been your favorite?
To be honest, Slinger's had a pretty good one. It was full of honesty and, you know, pretty deep insight that isn't always the case. So, yeah, he's pretty open, and you don't necessarily always get that. So it was really nice to listen to.
Yeah, he was really honest, wasn't he? Particularly about his Olympic campaign. We've had a lot of messages about that, a lot of learnings for lots of people. Riley, you're one of the younger sailors here at American Magic. Tell us what your role is. You know, what's your role within the team?
Yeah, I think my role within the team here at American Magic, it's evolved a little bit. I was initially brought on as we weren't sure if it was going to be all that full time. I was still wanting to pursue the Olympics in Paris 2024. And, you know, as I thought about it, and I mean, it's pretty hard to pass up an opportunity like this. And, you know, opportunities like this, again, they don't come all that often. So when they do, you kind of should probably take it. At least a lot of mentors of mine from home and whatnot kind of all agreed. And yeah, so here I am. But anyways, my role within the team, I was brought in initially to be a backup helm of sorts. And obviously, you know, this cup cycle's unique in this day and age where we can do two-boat testing. And that was an amazing opportunity. You know, everyone even dreams of being a part of a team like this, and to help as much as I've been have been able to has been phenomenal. But really a dream come true, honestly, like from sitting in diapers in front of the TV watching the cups in 2000 and 2003. But yeah, dream come true to be here.
Who did you phone, which mentor did you call up when you got the call?
Yeah, I've got quite a close village that supported me through, you know, my youth sailing and whatnot, and on through Olympic sailing, and kind of like to call them my village back at home. But Jay and PZ Glazier, they're silver medalists each themselves, and also Howard Hamlin and my parents, of course. But yeah, just really close friends from home.
Good decision.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good decision. Yeah. Riley, there is a whiteboard just outside the studio here. And for our listeners, it's a league table. Times up one of the cycling climbs here in Barcelona. I've heard it's a bit of an epic climb.
Yeah.
And there's a few pro cyclists in the cup these days, obviously. But Riley, your name is pretty near the top. You're pretty handy on a bike.
Yeah. I don't know. We're all extremely competitive. You know, we've all... I guess you could say you all have that dog in yourself, and you know, you get pretty aggressive at times. And no, it's just really fun to push not only yourself but your teammates, and really see what they're like when, you know, heart rates are really high and extremely competitive and, you know, on the edge. So no, it's been fun, and just got back from putting up another pretty decent time yesterday. So it's fairly competitive, let's say. There was even a bet on it that I heard. Goody may have lost, so.
Nice work. I mean, not just racing sailors up the mountain.
Yeah.
As pro cyclists.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely have a little bit of an edge because I'm not all that big. I only weigh, you know, high 70 kilos, so 160, 70 pounds or so. And, you know, the watts per kilo, I kind of even out a little bit with the elevation gain.
How did you join the team? Let's briefly talk about that. I mean, I guess Terry gave you a ring. I mean, how exciting was that?
Yeah. Funny enough, I tried to get involved last campaign and in more of the form of a nipper and just wanting to be exposed to it. At the time of my first, I guess, the first time I reached out to the team was prior to COVID and the postponement of the Tokyo Games. And I really wanted to be exposed to a team like this, you know, something that's as professional as the America's Cup, and just really see what it's all about and just be exposed to the environment. And in any capacity, I was willing to do whatever it took, you know, sweep the loft floors like I still do today and really just work your tail off to get where you can. But I, you know, couple wise people on the team, Terry, James Lyon included, both kind of, I guess, told me no and told me to just focus on the games. And in hindsight, that's definitely the right decision. You know, I was obviously youthful and fairly inexperienced, I'd say, and in regards to like a total understanding of what professional sailing looked like and how involved you need to be present in an environment like this. Regardless of that, I always wanted to be involved here, and I think I made that pretty clear to Terry from pretty early on, and fortunately got a phone call from him about midway through the Moth Worlds in 2021 and while we were all in Garda and after the Olympics, and expressed a little bit of interest in having me, you know, in some way or another be a part of the team going forward.
That's a good day.
Yeah. I mean, I was jumping out of my skin at the cafe after I hung up. So, pretty amazing. Yeah.
It's been a while, Riley, since the Cup's been back in the hands of the New York Yacht Club. 40 years, in fact. Explain to us how big a deal it is as a sailor from the U.S. sailing for this trophy.
Yeah, I guess growing up, there were a number of American teams, whether it was in when the Cup was in San Diego and whatnot, and it's dwindled down to, you know, your single challenger or defender in the last couple cycles and being Oracle and, you know, pretty phenomenal what they were able to pull off. But, you know, there's always this undertone of, well, maybe it wasn't all that American. And so from a young age, you know, you aspire to prove that Americans are totally capable of, you know, being successful at the highest level of the sport. So I try to represent that as best I can, and hopefully one day I can be a part of a team win.
Is it slightly intimidating?
Extremely.
Sailing for the New York Yacht Club?
Extremely, yeah.
When you go to that trophy room?
Yeah, empty trophy room.
Yes, yeah. Good point.
Yeah.
They still kept a spot.
Yeah.
Just in case.
Yeah.
Do you think it's still the case, Riley? I mean, you know, for the next generation of U.S. sailing talent, I know it is for you, you're involved in it, but I mean, is the Cup still the pinnacle of the sport?
I would say so, yeah, without a doubt. I mean, the America's Cup is the end-all, be-all, let's say. It's got everything I would ever aspire to be a part of. I mean, a technological arms race and, you know, sailing the fastest boats in the world and being a part of a team this big, it's a massive undertaking. It's not really like anything I've experienced before, and super lucky to be here. I mean, working with a team of around 200 people, so it's impressive.
Let's talk about that team.
Yeah.
I mean, some pretty big names in your sailing squad. I mean,
yeah.
Give us a glimpse of what it's like. How are you enjoying sailing with Tom, Goody, Andrew Campbell, of course?
Yeah. The experience is unmatched. I mean, a wise coach once told me that you're only as strong as your weakest link, and I would consider myself exactly that in this team. So I put an immense amount of pressure on myself sitting behind, you know, whether it be Goody or Slingers when we're tuning, racing, whatever. I definitely hold myself to an extremely high standard, and I need to know that I can perform and be there for Tom and Slingers and, you know, Andrew, whoever my teammates may be. I just need to pull just as hard as them and, you know, feel like I deserve to be there in only time, really, will that bring. So time and experience, but scary.
Scary.
Yeah,
way?
It's just a lot of weight on your shoulders. I mean, it's a lot of responsibility and an immense amount of pressure. I imagine anyone would put on themselves, you know.
I mean, Slingsby in particular, it seems like it's his moment. He's doing well in all arenas. I mean, how much are you learning from him?
Just tons. I mean, every debrief, every capture meeting we go through, there's always, you know, little golden nuggets, whether it's, you know, quite often about moth sailing or you know, AC40 sailing, 75 sailing, an enormous amount of experience that's directly applicable from the 50 to what, you know, these platforms are. You just try and write it down as fast as you can in your notebook.
You have the AC-75 Patriot out on the water. There's the AC-40, obviously. Are you all jumping from one boat to the other? I mean, how does all that work? I mean, that can't be easy.
No, and it puts an immense amount of weight on the guys in the shed, you know, getting the boats ready each and every day. So we try to be as efficient as we can. You know, time's the only commodity you can't buy in this game, and we try to use it as efficiently as we possibly can. So we've done our training blocks periodically based on schedules and whatnot, whether it be design or competition based. So for example, most recently we've been sailing Patriot. It's been great to be back in the big bus, and it definitely feels like a behemoth after sailing the little dinghies in the 40s around. So it's been phenomenal. Yeah.
What about the other teams, Riley? I mean, yeah. Who's looking good? There's a lot of talent, isn't there, in this fleet, in the sailors and the design office?
Yeah.
Everywhere. I mean, how does that make you feel?
I love my job. Every morning, it's like pinching myself. It's fantastic. So many individuals who come from so many different backgrounds. It's so unique. Like I've never been a part of a group of people this massive, and everyone is so motivated to do their role every day, and they're just kicking ass in every department. So it's super cool to be a part of. Yeah, that's my full honest opinion. I love it. Yeah.
It's so good to hear that. And when we come back, Riley, we want to see you in the top of that cycling lead board. First up the mountain.
Yeah.
It's been so great to meet you. And actually to hear your enthusiasm for it all. It's infectious. Hopefully, I'm sure actually, we'll have you on the podcast again.
Thanks,
good
Riley.
Luck.
All right.
Riley Gibbs, loving life in Barcelona with American Magic and buzzing on life as a pro sailor. It's great to talk to someone with so much passion for the sport. Our final chat is with the man that's pulled this team together, the figurehead of American Magic, running the team in this, his sixth America's Cup campaign, Terry Hutchinson. Well, Terry's been on the podcast a few times now and is here to give us a real insight into what it's like to run an America's Cup team. Terry Hutchinson back in the hot seat. It's so great to see you, Terry. It's been a while, hasn't it? We last spoke on the podcast back when Barcelona had just been announced as host venue. What was that, 18 months ago? And here we are sitting in a rather lovely audio studio built just for me, I'm hoping, Terry, in your team base in the heart of the city's very cool port. What's it been like bringing the USA to Catalonia?
For us, I think as a team, the transition, which started in February of last year from Pensacola to Barcelona, has been, I think it's gone way better in a lot of ways than we expected. You know, we had a self-imposed sailing date of June 22nd of this summer. And, you know, amazingly, we met it. I would say a lot of that goes to the shore side of our operation, but we're living inside of MB92, which is a super yacht facility here, and they've been incredibly gracious hosts to us and have really helped us meet our deadlines. And, you know, maybe every now and then they fudge the rules a little bit to allow us to get operational, but, you know, we're sitting here and you can still see construction and stuff going on around us. But for the most part, you know, the transition from a sailing side has been easy. The transition into the community has been really a lot easier than I would have thought. We've had a couple great teams through the legal and the immigration side. And when I look back at the time that we did it, you know, we maximized our time in Pensacola. We did some good design stuff there. And I think we've maximized our time here for sure. And now we're getting closer to the winter months. So it's going to be interesting to see how, you know, January, February, March of next year go for us. But you don't need to come into 2024 swinging for the fences straight away, because our goal is in October, September and October of that year.
Terry, you're so full of logistics and dates and deadlines. That's your life now, isn't it? It's all about that. But I have to explain to our listeners, your base is nestled in between the biggest super yachts, some of the biggest super yachts in the planet. And there is American Magic in the middle of it in this port. And especially now in the winter, so many of them come, you know, for their winter refit. It's quite an extraordinary setting. And when your crane's up, there's the biggest stars and stripes flying from the crane. It's a good spot.
It is a good spot. It's very cool. And you know, I think at first we were, because we have to walk all the way around the port to get here. Luna Rosa's just passed us, but it's nice to be a little bit removed. It's nice to be inside the port because the foot traffic is not as prevalent here. Everybody that comes in and out has to have a pass or has to be invited in as guests. And I think, as you rightfully point out, right now, this time of year, we have all these incredible boats around us. And it's impressive to see the operation. But we are lucky. MB92 has been very kind to us, and they're gracious hosts, so we're in a good spot.
Do you think it adds to the cup, Terry, being in, you know, a major destination like Barcelona? I mean, I'm guessing it'll be a big draw for the team's fans, you know, come race time next year.
It'll certainly be easier than Auckland. you know, we were the last team to we're the last challenger to leave Auckland. We had kept everything there until we had a clear pathway after the announcement that they were that the Defender was taking the cup out of New Zealand and bringing it to Barcelona. So I think for us, logistically, Barcelona is great. It's a 14-day ship from Pensacola direct to Barcelona, which is a pretty quick transit time. And, you know, so for us, it's a lot easier in a lot of ways because the time zone between the U.S. and here is just a better, it's centrally located. And I think, you know, from a viewership perspective, they're going to do a good job. The city's going to do a great job. And all the interactions that we've had with the city and the leadership here has been very, very positive. And so no reason to think that anything's going to change.
Yeah, I think we're already feeling quite welcome here in Barcelona.
Yeah.
I've raced here a fair bit, as I know you have too. Yeah. I mean, I did an Olympics here, I'm going to say quite some time ago.
In the Europe, right?
Yeah, in the Europe. And I've got to admit, it's not my favorite sailing venue. I mean, the waves seem to come from every direction except where the wind's coming from. And the weather is, well, it's complex. It's quite difficult. You know, you have some amazing people helping, but it's quite difficult to predict. I mean, this time, by the time you get to this time next year, it will all be over. Yeah. So you've actually been sailing here during the cut window. What have you learned, and how's the sailing been, and how's that impacted, I guess, your decision making?
Well, this year was the breeze was further right and the sea state was flatter and the temperatures were hotter. So the days that we would have missed because of no wind were probably higher. And the days that would have sailed, the wind speed would have been higher than what the statistical average has been. So, you know, I think from a design perspective, it was a little bit different than certainly we were expecting. Your comparison to the Olympics is probably a good one, though, because the courses that we're sailing, I don't know what the length of your beat was in a Europe, but, you know, here the courses really, you know, our courses, our beats are going to be 2 miles and the boundary maybe 0.7 of a mile. And so the weather, unlike past America's Cups where you would have a lot of investment into the first shift and winning the first cross, here you're going to have a lot of investment into the first cross. But once you win that first cross, you know, a lot of it's just boundary sailing. A lot of it is making sure that you can maneuver the boat, making sure that you have your percentage between upwind, downwind ratios and performance are equal enough that if you choose a boat that's a little bit faster upwind, you're not giving away so much downwind. And if you look at AC36, where, you know, Lumeros' foil was 48% bigger than Team New Zealand's, you know, that you could easily have seen a scenario where Luna Rosa would have won that match. It wouldn't have taken much. And so there's a great lesson inside of that, and you have to balance those things, especially when you contemplate the sea state. You contemplate that it is a Mediterranean wind, and so that breeze in September and October, when it's hot, that breeze won't be as dense. It'll be lighter. And so our abilities to foil at the bottom end of the protocol wind range is going to be critical. And we learned that lesson the hard way in AC36.
That's true.
Yeah.
It still must mess with your head a little bit, the weather here. I mean, you know, you're trying to build and design, you know, the fastest boat, and yet the racetrack is essentially quite unpredictable.
It is, and I think the changes in the class rules, the boat's getting lighter, the foil arm getting deeper, the span getting a little bit bigger, it's going to drive the fleet all into probably the same area. And so what are your regatta winning things? You know, certainly the foils are, but I bet you, based on what we've seen with a lot of the LEQ foils, I bet you all the teams end up in roughly the same spot. You're not going to see a 48% difference in foil size. I mean, maybe you'll see a 15% difference in foil size, and that's almost an immeasurable amount. That's one or two waves that the boat skids and loses grip. So, you know, those type of things, they weigh on you. They weigh on us probably to the extent that we don't want to be too far out of touch where the competitors are. And, you know, there's an area of the rule and the development of the systems of the rule that is quite complex, you know, where there's a 2-second delay into the software where you can actuate a trim function and then nothing will happen. And then 2 seconds later, you can program your boat to do a couple different things. And I think that's an area of development that all the teams will be thinking about. Certainly when you look at a team like Ineos or Lingi, who's supported by an F1 operation, you know, there's probably a lot of technological support that those teams get from the car racing side of it. And then, you know, certainly Team New Zealand, for their part, you know, they wrote it. So you'd have to think if you were smart, you would have already had a pretty reasonably large head start at that side of it. And so I can see the boats and the sails and all of these things narrowing to a point that you get much closer in the racing. And, you know, we're certainly, I think that if that philosophy is correct, that'll play well into American Magic's hands.
What worries you about that process and, you know, and this venue when you look ahead? What keeps you up at night?
I think the things that worry me the most is if you look at all the teams, I would suspect we've sailed the most, and balancing, you know, for the first 6 months of 2024, making sure that we give ourselves enough time to really get boat 3 sorted. And we only have so much human resource that when we take our AC-40s off the dock and we go sailing, it draws resource out of the development of boat 3. And so we have to be smart there, but we have great sailors, and everybody's competitive, and everybody wants to go out and go sailing, and we're a professional sailing team. So having the discipline to make sure that we don't take on too much sailing at the risk of compromising the other development, that worries me. The unforeseen, you know, that AC-36 was a great lesson in things that I never thought would happen, happened, and we were properly staffed for it, but you know, we know what happened there. And so, you know, those are things that are well within our control. And so we have to make sure we don't shoot ourselves in the foot. And so those are the things that probably keep me awake. And then, you know, just staying true to the methodical process of developing the boat and developing the team and developing the gear. Those are big ones.
Let's talk sailing team. I mean, not long after the Barcelona announcement, you made a big signing. I mean, I'm going to say the hottest draft in the sport, multiple World Sailor of the Year. I mean, he's just won the title for the extraordinary third time. I mean, Tong Slingsby, of course. I mean, fortunately for you guys, given the tightening of the nationality rules, who would have known? He has an American mum. I mean, how did that conversation go? Who approached who?
We approached him, and we started talking. We started talking at the end of the 21 TP52 season in Barcelona at the 52 Worlds. Kind of, it was a condensed season, and it was November of 21. And you know, we had great conversations, and you know, obviously, Tom's a very competitive person, and it's been. there's been a couple highlights thus far in the development of our team, and it's getting to know him. It's getting to know Goody in a different way, because I think collectively those two sailors, their experience in the Moth and their experience in the smaller foiling boat is something that is irreplaceable in the AC-40 and in the AC-75. And that's, last week we were out sailing, we bore away in about 16 knots of breeze and started going 51 knots. And you can feel the rudder stalling, and you know, I'm just sitting on Patriot, just sitting there bracing for impact. And you can, you know, and the ice water there in both those guys' veins as they're talking in the comms, like nothing's happening. And meanwhile, the boat's shaking all over the place. And I think that I think they complement each other. They're obviously competitors from past Olympic Games, but we've had a couple great team building sessions where they've talked about a lot of these a lot of the challenges that they faced in the younger years in life, which is really it's impressive, because we've all shown each other a little bit of our, you know, our human side, and those are things that will take the team to the next level. And you know, ultimately, our goal and our jobs have to be to put those guys in a spot that we have a fast enough boat that allows their skills to be on display, and that's the I think that's exciting. Because I think our possibilities and our potential is, of all the teams, we have a really steep gain rate. You know, it's not a plateaued. We're not sitting here 10 months out or 11 months out thinking, well, we're at our best. We're probably not even scratching the surface. And so if we can keep it all moving forward and keep all the pieces to the puzzle, just putting it together day by day, then there's a real opportunity in front of us.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the design team. I mean, there's been some movement, hasn't there, between between all the teams.
Yeah.
I mean, how much do you learn from influences coming in, but yet at the same time, how much do you worry that someone in this team last time is now sitting at a different design desk?
Yeah. I worry about that. I mean, first, we had a great relationship with Marcelino and Botin Partners and Aldolfo and the group that was with us before. It is disappointing to see them sitting over at Olinghi, because, you know, we spent 4 years developing that IP, and it's American Magic IP, and we wanted them. They're great partners, and they've done great boats for us. So in that same breath, it has been, I've never worked with Brett Ward or Pete Melvin, and Brett's from Annapolis. And there's a certain component of you know, being able to talk to somebody who's literally 10 minutes away. Not that I ever bothered him that much. I would go over there occasionally, but you know, you want to stay out of their hair and let them do their jobs. You don't want to get in their way, but it's fun to listen to the conversations and really hear how they're thinking. And then, you know, last week I was in Portsmouth looking at the boat being built and watching it and seeing what the team there is doing. It's incredible.
Terry, I often think of your drama in Auckland. I mean, I'll never forget it.
Me neither.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, the capsize, the will they, won't they come back story. I mean, from the outside, it was dramatic, filmic even, but largely a story that unfolded behind the shed door. Yeah. For us trying to share the stories, and I mean, your team were amazing in that respect, but often all we had were snippets of information as the drama unfolded. For this cup, though, Hollywood has arrived. We've got a Drive to Survive style film crew documenting it all. I mean, have you watched the All or Nothings, the Drive to Survive, all of those films? And how do you feel about that, about the cup as a landscape for all of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the... I think anything we can do to promote our sport is a good thing. I've enjoyed meeting the producers, because I really enjoy watching the Free Solo movie. I mean, that to me is just a story beyond stories. I grew up as a huge Michael Jordan fan, and so watching The Last Dance was equally as good. And Drive to Survive has propelled F1 in the United States to a level well beyond I would suspect they were even thinking that it was going to. So to have the opportunity to display our sport in the manner that they have the potential to do is a gain for all the teams and for our marketability and for our sport. So that's an absolute win. And, you know, we just need to make sure we write the correct ending.
Let's talk about the timeline. I mean, what's happening? What's happening next? I mean, a lot of design decisions have obviously been made. You're in build.
Yeah.
When does the new boat launch? And what's the team's focus once all that happens?
Yeah. So what's today? Now, the rest of 23 will be spent in Patriot working on the systems of the boat and working on the cycler systems of the boat. And 24 will probably start out very similarly to that. And then we will transition our focus into match race practice in the AC40s. And then boat three will show up late May, early June, and we'll get into it. But we've mapped out a very similar plan to what we had in Auckland to allow ourselves enough time to commission the boat and get boat three to a spot that, you know, we can get into the racing. We were informed by the organizing authority that I think it's July 23rd. I have to go back and check my calendars that we're going to be open up to start racing against the other competitors if we want to. And, so from a team perspective, our commissioning and lead-in in AC36 was about the right amount of time. And here there's less to do in foil world. And so, you know, we've set ourselves on the same trajectory that we had there to work up boat three and get ourselves into a spot. But it's hard to believe that, you know, like you said, this time next year will would have been done for a month of the regatta and packing everything up to go somewhere else.
It passes quickly,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a worry, actually. Now that
it's final year.
My palms are starting to sweat, so.
And what about you, Terry? The pressure that, as we say, the constant ticking of the clock, the Excel spreadsheet, I can tell, is sort of permanently in your head. Are you enjoying it all?
Well, it's a different role. But I made the comment, we had a really good sailing team building session last week, and I made the comment this past year I didn't do a lot of racing, but we had the opportunity to win the Maxi Worlds with Hap on Belamente, which was just awesome. But equally as awesome was to watch our team win the event in Villanova and not be on the boat. But I had the same sense of relief that I did watching them race as I did when we won with Belamente. And that tells me by that very nature that I'm engaged and I'm doing my job as best I possibly can to help facilitate the guys that are racing the boat and to facilitate supporting the operation. But it is different. And, you know, it's not the salt water in your face and the absolute effort on the water, but it's a different type of effort. And I think in some ways I was relieved that I felt that, because that just means that I'm tuned in and I'm focused on doing the job of helping support those guys as best I possibly can. And that's, you know, the end of it. That's all. I mean, win, lose, or draw, it'll take all of us to do any one of those. And so, you know, I think the other benefit of my age is that you can have that perspective. You know, you can see, you know, where 10 years ago I would have growled at that thought, but now it's a much different time. And the athletes and the sailors they're different, and they're in these boats. They're incredibly good. I mean, it's awesome to watch. And having sailed on Patriot and had a couple days to sail on the AC40, you know, going down winning the AC40 with a 20-something sitting behind me, and I'm staring, taking video as we're ripping along at 40 knots, and he's asking me to put my camera away because it's just so cool. But, you know, to race the boat in the manners that the guys race the boat, it's a different sailor and it's a different skill set. So I'm happy to support it.
I mean, Terry, this is your team. You made this team happen. You brought in Hap and Doug and the New York Yacht Club, and you've brought it all together. I mean, it's a terrible question, I think, this, but, you know, look ahead to this time next year. What would it mean if you'd had a good, solid America's Cup?
Well, yeah, I mean, I look at it in a bit of a twisted lens, probably, because there's only one result that's going to be a good, solid America's Cup. But AC36 taught us that you can do a lot of things really well and still not win. I think that I appreciate your words, but it's our team. You know, it's Hap and Doug and the New York Yacht Club and all 172 people that are here, that we all play our part in it. And so I'm fortunate to have had the opportunity to race with those guys and to experience some incredible successes on the race course. And when we finished in Villanova, Doug was standing on the bow, and we called Hap on FaceTime. And we're all of us are standing on the bow of the boat, and we call Hap on FaceTime, and the first thing Doug says is, "Wow, Hap, I'm impressed that you could answer that," which was just awesome because he was so into it, and he was so excited. And that small, not meaningless, but doesn't really count anything, that moment for him and for Doug and Hap was an incredible small payback to their commitment to this team and to our sport, really. And so I'm grateful every single day that they allow me to be a part of it.
Terry Hutchinson, as always, great to catch up, and a massive thank you for your time, but also your team's time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Terry Hutchinson, paying tribute there to two very important figures in the world of competitive sailing, Doug DeVos and Hap Fouth, backers of American Magic, but also huge supporters of the sport as a whole, and both pretty handy behind the wheel themselves. Doug also happens to be a fellow podcaster. If you weren't aware of that, check out Believe with Doug DeVos, an inspiring series of interviews with some of America's brightest business minds. Before we go, a big thanks to everyone at American Magic, to Terry and all the guys we sat down to chat to. Many, many thanks. And to Graham Harrison for helping pull it all together. Many thanks. Until next time, if you're enjoying what we do, support the pod. It's really easy. Wherever you are, head over to buymeacoffee.com/sailingpodcast and help us bring you these uninterrupted ad-free chats from all around the sport of sailing. Your support means a lot. Before we go, this podcast wouldn't exist without the tireless enthusiasm of Tim at Vertigo Films. Tim, a big thanks for all your hard work making this happen. Do keep in touch via social media. It's great to hear from you. I'm Shirley Sale on Instagram and Twitter, and Shirley Robertson on Facebook. It's great to hear your thoughts on the podcast. Well, that's all from us this month. Thank you so much for listening. Have fun on the water and sail safe, everyone.
This is Castle One. Race officer speaking.
Blackout is on boundary up ahead, 35 seconds out.
A bit lower and faster here.
Ho, ho, ho. That's a good one, Jimmy.
Still gaining on the line right there.
We're looking at 10.5 and 42.
Matching him on the boundary, yeah. Copy.
This is Castle One standing by. Out.